All right, well, after 6, I'll call the meeting to order. I don't know if all of you guys have a chance to look over the minutes.
Yes.
Good, if you did, I don't know.
I'll make that to the
second day there. All right, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. Yeah, we've got a couple guest speakers tonight. Our first guest speaker is Richard. Eggenpoff?
Eggman.
He's the founder of the HCLV National Registry. He contacted me about 5 months anyway because he's on behalf of the registry and the work that you've done. I was obviously passionate about it and want to discuss it with the committee. If possible, we'd like to keep it 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Great. Well, you're on.
Thanks very much. We're hoping that this might generate perhaps a memorializing resolution in support of the statewide legislative response to the HCLV epidemic, which we don't, in New York State, we can't confirm the size of the epidemic, nor can we confirm the number of county residents who are carriers, because these have been kept off the state reportable diseases list. That's one of the major disparities. But even worse, there's no printed information, no pamphlets or posters, not in any SPG clinic, not in any hospital, not in any doctor's office, that HCLV exists. And they're viewed as cousins. They're related to HIV. They're slower and less aggressive, but at least one of the HCLVs can cause a very aggressive cancer in about 5% of the carriers. It's usually a slow development process, taking years or even decades. But should the cancer appear, it generally doesn't respond to chemotherapy and it's rapidly fatal, typically killing in 6 months. So for that reason, the Food and Drug Administration ordered all the blood banks to screen for HCLV, along with HIV way back in 1988. But because there's no printed information, the general public has no idea, in the vast majority of cases, that this is happening. And the NIH believes that less than 5% of the general public are aware that HCLV exists, and probably less than 30% of doctors in the U.S. Well, we've surveyed hospitals, including Hampton Hospital, and spoken to doctors who are managing or attending the emergency room, and they're unable to define HCLV. But so anyway, we constructed some educational materials several years ago to show how complex and potentially hazardous or confounding the actual situation is with human retroviruses, that there are more than just HIV infecting humans. So this is sort of a brief history of the discovery of retroviruses. The first one was called HFV. Before it was known to be a retrovirus, it was suspected to be a retrovirus. It was defined as human foamy virus. But by 1978, it was proven to be a retrovirus, and it got renamed as HSRV, or human retrovirus. It's believed to be a microscopic player in terms of epidemics. The CDC has only confirmed a few hundred cases of zoonosis. We probably contracted it from an infected monkey. It's unclear if they have symptoms, apparently not, and it might not be sexually transmittable. So that's, relatively minor player. But the second one discovered was isolated from an American in 1980, and he died, unfortunately, rapidly, in less than 15 months. He had something which was later proven to be something called adult T-cell leukemia monoclonal, or ATLL. So it was 1980, and at that point it was thought to be a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, or CTCL, so it was first defined as human cutaneous T-cell lymphoma virus in 1980, but then 2 years later, a second one was found. It was structurally a little bit different from the first. It had a couple of proteins that were unique to it. They concluded it's a type 2, and that one caused the call of cancer. The victim or the carrier lasted for about 7 or 8 years, we were told. It was a leukemia, a hairy cell leukemia. So at that point, HCLV2 at that point, the pair, HLV and HLV1 and HLV2 became defined as human T-cell leukemia forward slash lymphoma viruses. But by 1983, they were duly defined and classified also as human T-cell lymphotropic viruses. And in case you're wondering what T-cell lymphotropic means, the term tropism relates to the type of cell that any contagion prefers to first infect. And in this case of these special viruses called retroviruses, it's always immune cells, usually T cells. So they coined the term T cell lymphotropic, or T cells of the type of white blood cell called the lymphocyte. And so that was 1982. Then the third retrovirus, this is the critical story in the politics of this, because there are extreme political policy disparities surrounding these. In the early 1980s, a mysterious disease affecting people's immune systems first appeared, and eventually got defined as AIDS-acquired immune deficiency syndrome, where people were abruptly, for unknown reasons at that point, identified of commonly occurring microinvaders, such as fungus spores that float around the atmosphere, and people were dying from them in droves. And NCI and also some other governments suspected it was a retrovirus, but it wasn't proven until 1983 by the French. And they called their strains lymphadenopathy-associated virus. Lymphadenopathy is the technical medical term for swelling of glands, which is usually the first symptom of prodrome. But in the United States, it was also isolated in 1984, by 1984 it was independently isolated by the Americans from people who had AIDS, but they at first they believed that this AIDS-causing third retrovirus was a close relative of HTLV-1 and HTLV-2, because it was structurally very similar. So it got defined as HTLV-3, and the paper that announced the discovery of the AIDS-causing retrovirus, a new, more aggressive retrovirus, HTLV-3 is the cause of AIDS. But what happened here, the politics of this, was that at a virology conference in 1986, which was under the auspices of an international body, it's called the International Committee for Taxonomy of Viruses, or ICTV, they concluded that there were three different subtypes of retrovirus based on their structure. They concluded that the structures of HLV-1 and HLV-2 were significantly different from the structure of HLV-3. It's more complex genomically. It has extra genes and extra proteins that have very aggressive functions that kill off the T cells. They proved that that was the cause of AIDS, the T cell numbers decreasing. Whereas HLV-1 and HLV-2 infect the T cells, but they don't kill them off. So they classified HLV-1 and HLV-2 in a separate subtype of retrovirus called onco-retrovirus, whereas the third retrovirus, HLV-3, got classified as lenti-retrovirus. And the third member was the one I showed you first, human spumer retrovirus, which is that one member of that subspecies. But more consequentially, it was then proposed by a group of biologists to change the name of the third AIDS-causing retrovirus in the United States, change the name from HLV-3 to the then new HIV, standing for human immunodeficiency virus. And some of the NCI researchers who we surveyed and basically we sent letters to at ex-Congressman Hinchey's request told us that they were against the name change, and they voted against it. But yes, let's change the name from HLV-3 to HIV Group 1, and a majority rules at this committee. So the third retrovirus got its name changed to HIV. And interestingly, we view it as unacceptable. After that, pamphlets and posters were made available for the American public disclosing HIV. No pamphlets and no posters were ever printed disclosing or explaining HTLV. The reasons for that, Congressman Hinchey was thinking of calling hearings about it, but that never occurred. But anyway, what happened then was in 1987, a second HIV made its way over from Africa, although this is present also in not microscopic, but very small numbers, only a few thousand Americans are carriers, and that became known as HIV-2. So at that point, HIV became HIV-1 in 1987. And the politics of this, the Food and Drug Administration are responsible for protecting the safety of the American blood supply, mandated to do so under federal law. They were aware that there were four major STD retroviruses infecting Americans, and reports had already documented not only disease but deaths from carriers of all four. So the FDA's committee, they called the BPAC, the Blood Products Advisory's Committee, they did the right thing in 1988. They ordered all the blood banks to screen for HWV and HCV2 along with HIV. But there's still no printed information for the public about HCV. So that's, you know, the political disparities. But then this was our name, if you see the name of our organization.
I don't mean to cut into it. I know that there probably only have 3 or 4 minutes left.
Oh, okay. Yes.
To where
the meat of the matter.
Yeah, like where you're looking for our help and all.
Oh, okay.
On, so.
Well, what we've already confirmed the presence of at least 14 Kingston residents. Our group uncovered already prior to 2006 14 cases of HCV infection, and all but one, they're all carriers. All the cases we're tracking have HCV, so all but one have serious symptoms, and one actually died in 2005 at the age of only 49. So, again, we're trying to get the matter legislated, and at Kevin Cahill's request, we began reviewing HIV responsive public health laws, which are viewed as inadequate because they don't basically address the second related epidemic, spreading an uncontrolled illness. So we developed bill models to add needed HCV language. It has, for instance, HIV/AIDS/HCV. Dual response, and the previous health committee a few years ago in 2007, at least 3 of the members, you know, signed off, gave us letters of support on the need for the bills. Congressman Gibson has the bills in his office, as does, I met with Cecilia Kacek also. Pete Lopez has the bills. Pete Lopez is thinking of raising the matter in the upcoming session. So we were, you know, because this is, the bottom line is it's costing the health and the lives, or even the lives, of an unknown number of county residents, which is unacceptable. And needs to be, the actual size of the epidemic can only be, and county by county analyses can only be performed by adding HCV to the reportable diseases list, as was correctly done in Idaho and Louisiana. So, you know,
one offset question. So, if someone has HCLV 2 or 3 or 1, they're characterized as HIV? Is that?
No.
Okay.
No.
So
they may or may not have HIV.
Right. So
usually HIV negative.
So they do get diagnosed as having HCLV 2 or
3? Oh, yeah. That's one
3.
Of the disparities. There are commercially available blood tests that will tell a person if they have HCLV, and if so, which type. A few doctors know that any of this is happening, including, as I mentioned, very few doctors in hospital emergency rooms know that this is happening.
Well, when someone gets a blood test because they're not feeling well, who determines that they have HCV?
That would be the only way they would find out, is if they donate blood. People are not routinely, when they're given or offered HIV tests, for instance, and that relates to one of the policy disparities, jails are required under New York State law to support their community for high-risk behaviors. They're required to offer them HIV tests. They call it opt-in HIV testing. But they're not required to counsel them or offer them HCV tests. And a person could be exposed to one, you could be exposed to the other, you could be exposed to both. There's a person available blood test.
So the bills are going to discern for the health community what they're looking for and what they want these diseases to be categorized as. They want to be tested and want doctors to know how to test for this certain blood disease.
Yeah, well, it needs to be a dual response, basically, registratively, all bills. The entire body of HIV laws in New York State are only semi-responsive, and that's a mild way of putting it. They're inadequate, they're unacceptable, defective. The second epidemic, we don't know the actual size of it, and it's not even, there's no attempt even to control it or to contain it. So that's why we're hoping the county legislature could issue some sort of, vote on a federalizing resolution in support of the state.
You don't have to copy the bills, do you?
I could bring you a copy.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
We have about 18 bill models Some of the possible aspects of this slide bar are very disturbing. The fact that the hospital doctors are usually unaware of the existence of HDLD means that if they're presented with victims of sex assault, usually female rape victims, but obviously they could be males or even children, if they're not aware of HDLD, they're required under state law and New York State Department of Health protocol to walk to counsel and order tests for only HIV, HBV, and HCV. HDLD is never deleted, by the way. So we did a model, essentially, it's only a six-page document. We placed HDLD in the number two position. That's how the Food and Drug Administration knew it, second in household insurance, both on the HIV. So it then becomes HIV, HDLD, combination of HIV and HCV.
Yeah, it's going to be about that time, so I have to try it.
Yeah. I propose that we get copies of the bills and look them over because
I don't want to
vote on
it. Back in 2006, you had brought this to the health committee's attention. And
yeah.
You got individual support, right? Did you get committee support or you didn't have a memorializing resolution?
No memorializing resolution was in the past. But when I met with Peter Lopez, he said that such a memorializing resolution would really help. The taxable budget for this in the first year, it would be not even the millions, it might cost them the tens of millions for the first year or two. But after that, it would reduce or decrease back to maintenance costs. Because we concluded that the need for printed, by the way, our premise is still that the core of public awareness of STDs or lack thereof is still printed posters and pamphlets. You know, when you walk into an STD clinic, you don't usually see a computer flashing names of diseases. You usually see posters and pamphlets on the wall. So if you see on the wall an HIV poster, an HPV poster, an HCV poster, you think you might have any of those, and you can take pamphlets, which are now stored in the database. But there's no HTLV information. That one item alone, we concluded, could cost $3 or $4 million, just in the state alone. But the fact that the hospital doctors almost never counsel or offer testing for HDLD could mean that there are victims of sexual assault who are exposed and infected who won't know it at this point. No, the doctors, so we drafted a bill that addresses that, a 110-page bill.
Yeah, and if you get those to us, I know we'd definitely be interested in looking at them.
Sure.
As a committee now, I wouldn't feel comfortable putting our support behind it. We're actually missing one of our members this evening. So, individually, yes, but until, if we have a chance, we'll go to add the bills.
Okay. I can drop off the first three bills that were endorsed in writing by the previous legislators again.
Sure.
And then I could drop off the, because it's a big read, it's a hefty read. Sure. The first three bills total are only 35 pages. But the second bill, I included a lot of support information, including from blood testing laboratories. Quest Diagnostics sent us a contract, but I wrote a note on that page. They were charged, by the way, to get all one of the disturbing sidebars is that there are 35,000 sex offenders on the New York State Sex Offender Registry list. The Department of Corrections stated that they have no information, no data on the HDLD status of any of their inmates, not even the sex offenders. So the 35,000 all should be tested, and that would cost $20 each. That would be 700,000. With 35,000, by the way, the NIH expects the full work tested. They expect to find 35. They believe one in 1,000 Americans is a carrier. So we present that as a likelihood model that needs to be confirmed.
And we look forward to looking at the
Can I make a suggestion that we have the legislative court contact Assemblyman Lopez? He's a strong supporter and has the bill, and he can send it to us electronically, or at least give us our website so we can grab it. And then you can send it to the committee members so we can all look at it.
Okay.
That would be quicker and more efficient.
Anything else from the committee?
Just a second quick question. So in Idaho and Louisiana, after this new legislation was passed, is there a large spike in the discovery of carriers in cases?
Well, no. Actually, we were surprised that Idaho requires reporting and investigating, but apparently they don't have a big budget, so they may not be able to afford the investigating. Because when a person with HIV is when the New York State Department of Health gets the name of the person who's from a blood testing laboratory first diagnosed with HIV, The first thing they're supposed to do is call them up, make sure that they know that they're HIV positive. But then the investigation is called a protocol for contact notification. They ask them, who do you think you might have gotten this from? But more importantly, do you think you might have exposed anybody before you found out you were HIV positive? And if they answer yes, in other words, if that...
Wait a minute. Was there a spike in Idaho or Louisiana?
Okay. The Idaho prevalence was, the reported HTLV prevalence in Idaho was running about 1/7 that of the reported HIV prevalence. And the reported HIV prevalence from the years 2002, I believe it was, to 2008, were only about 202, I think the number was in Idaho, versus, I think the number was 27. The double HTLV epidemic was running only about 1/7 the size of the reported HIV epidemic. The NIH believes that it will be somewhere, nationally, it will be somewhere between 1/4 and 1/7.
So
we don't know if that's a spike. There are a few cases being reported. But Louisiana just added HTLV at my recommendation last year. They had a special meeting about this, and their epidemiologist has been agreeing for several years. And so it's going to take maybe another 6 months. I'm hoping that this winter, when they do their annual report, they may have some county-by-county breakdown.
So you don't think it's been out long enough yet to get an accurate sampling of all the population parameter to affect the data, essentially, is what you're saying?
Yeah, well, it needs to be national. We're trying to get Congressman Gibson's,
We'll move on. We have our next guest speaker this evening is I'm engaged to discuss some issues facing the cities of Walker Valley, specifically and throughout the county, regarding the billing practices of both BLS and ALS services.
Mm-hmm. I only have six of these. I don't know if you want to share them or. I'm here to represent all my knowledge now about what's happening in our community for the Because in 2009, I was at the YMCA, and I thought the machine was broken and didn't realize I was broken. And I was very fortunate. My daughter-in-law was at the Y and a nurse friend. And I didn't realize it, but I didn't feel well. And so they put me in a chair, and they were trying to take my pulse, and they couldn't get it. And I joked and said, do you have an AED? And the girlfriend was a cardiac nurse. And she immediately put the aid, because then my pulse stopped. Then I lost my oxygen, and I knew I was dying. And I could hear all the instructions when she was putting the AED on me. And it said, step back from the patient. And just as it said that, they called 911. And paramedic is screaming, don't shock her. And the nurse shocked me. I was conscious and saved my life. I could have gone back on the treadmill. So that started my... Entity. But 2 weeks later, they couldn't find anything wrong with me. Paramedic was furious because the Y didn't have a printout in their machine, and they didn't know what happened to me. And 2 weeks later, they sent me for all kinds of tests, and I was very healthy, no problem. 2 weeks later, it was like 1:30 in the morning, and I live out in the country, and I live probably 2 football fields back in the woods, and it was covered with ice in my driveway. And about 1:30, my heart started beating again, but I knew I was having trouble. And I called 911. I had a heart monitor on, and the 911 must have called Mobile Life. But anyway, 30 firemen were in my house in about 3 minutes, I swear. And then the voluntary ambulance came, and the husband of the wife that was at the Y that was serious for the girl that saved my life he, somebody kept calling him, and he was asking all kinds of questions, and he said, you know, if we'd known what had happened to you, if you thought my wife had saved your life, we'd known what had happened to you. And I said, I know what happened to me, because I came home from the hospital and called the people that made the machine, and they never went into cardiac arrest. And so they put me in the ambulance, they took me down to the end of the driveway, and at the end of the driveway, there was the mobile life was there, and they were furious because the firemen wouldn't let them down to my house. And I was involved in a paramedic intercepted. And do you all, are you aware of what a paramedic intercepted?
Mm-hmm.
In what? Okay. What happened is because our legislators made a bill, I think back in 1999, that if I needed a paramedic, not just basic life saving, then the mobile life could charge Medicare and the volunteer. And they decided that maybe the seniors, I guess, would cheat them or whatever. So now they made a law that only the volunteer ambulance could bill. So if you're involved in a paramedic intercept, which is when the volunteer will get to my house first because I live in a rural area, and they put me in their ambulance and they start toward the hospital, and the paramedic intercepts, they'll meet the paramedics, will get on the volunteer ambulance with their equipment, and they can get drugs and do all the testing. Well, once that happens, I found out 2 weeks later that I got a bill for $675. And I was shocked, and I found out that there's a page in here. It really defines paramedic intercepts there. But there's a page in here when I got the bill, which I'm having our things in order, I apologize, that Mobile Life sends out with their billing. And it explains paramedic intercept, and it explains now how bad it is that they have to charge the senior citizens, and it said write their legislators. And when I think things are wrong, I wrote my legislators. And Hinty and Gillibrand are top. I lost Hinty, but Gillibrand's still around. Mm. So anyway, I immediately wrote them, and everything calmed down, and I didn't hear anything else. And so I thought, well, they must have taken care of it for me. Well, in 2010, I kept having problems, and at least they knew what was wrong with me after I got the printout. And in June 2010, I was involved in another incident where they took me to the hospital, and I needed a paramedic intercept. And then a week later, I was involved again, and I didn't need a paramedic intercept, and I got 2 bills, each for $675. So I called up and said, how come the last one paid? Well, my insurance had taken a mistake. And so then I'm really upset about it. So I contacted Gillibrand and she again, and Steve Lester, I think I got a letter from him, he called up and said, Gillibrand, and said she can file an appeal with Medicare. And they actually helped me file the appeal. And so anyway, and in the meantime, I'm hearing all these stories about these seniors that are being charged these horrible ambulance bills that they can't pay. And so anyway, I got a hold of them again, and Gillibrand helped me fill out an appeal. And that was in, that was September 2010 or October. And in January, and there was a big article in the paper about somebody from Walton, big article on another senior citizen getting stuck with heavy bills like this. And I opened the mail in January, and I wrote my appeal, and I was like totally ecstatic. And I won for both cases. They sent me a notice of January 1st, I think January 10th, they paid it. So I couldn't wait to tell Mobile Life Services what they had done. And the guy at Mobile Life Services told me we're sending the money back. So I called the newspaper that had written that article, and they did a big article in the newspaper about the problem, which is attached here too, which made some people aware of it, but also not enough to really change anything. So anyway, the person at Mobile Life Services was serious. That was wrong, it wasn't fair to everybody else, and they're going to send the money back. So they sent the payments back. they paid, you know, Medicare paid. However, Medicare pays $353, and Mobile Life costs $675 per month. So there's no incentive for them to do anything about it. And in order to qualify, you have to live in a rural area. You have to need advanced services. And the third thing is, unfortunately, the Mobile Life and the volunteer have to have a contract. And so I contacted our local, and they said they've had so many problems with Mobile Life not, you know, accepting that, and they don't have a contract, and most of them don't have a contract. And one of the reasons is Mobile Life will not sign contracts with them. So I'm not... But now I'm not concerned about me. I started hearing from all these seniors that are getting stuck with these bills. I have three former students that are social workers, and said it happens all the time. And these people can't pay their bills, so actually we're paying the bills because what they do is they finally pay them for it.
They're bypassing 911 and calling the paramedics directly.
Well, that's what I called the lady that formally started it and owned it, because I did a lot of investigating. I called her, and she said there's a way to get around it. She said you call our number, you don't call 911. Well, when you live in a rural area, you can save somebody's life by, and we need our volunteer ambulance people, you can save somebody's life by starting them toward the hospital and then having them meet and then get the medicines and things that they need. So I wasn't happy with that reply. So anyway, the person at, I was going away on vacation in April, and I got a letter from the collection agency to pay my bill, pay one bill. They only, for some reason, Mobile Life only sent one of the bills in for June 14th. And so anyway, I called up Mobile Life and I said, I'm going away. I have information from Medicare showing that the bills were paid. And so anyway, I came home from my vacation. I was put into the hospital for a week with a cardiac arrest. And go home and rest. Monday morning at 8 o'clock, I got a horrendous call from the collection agency screaming and hollering at me and demanding my money and going to ruin your credit rating. And I kept telling her I have information to show that it's been paid. And I didn't care what Mobile Life said. They have been paid and they chose to return the money. So anyway, she finally screamed at me and slammed down the receiver. So I took them to the district attorney in New York State. So the district attorney, once got my information and everything, contacted the collection agency, and the collection agency says, I think they're, I don't know if it's a copy of a letter from them anyway. They refused to collect for Mobile Life anymore, which is nice, but I know there's other collection agencies. So September 1st, 2011, I opened up my mail, and I got a thing in there from Medicare stating that I lost my case, my appeal that I filed. And I'm looking through all this paper, and I didn't file an appeal. Why would I file an appeal when I won and my bill was paid? Mobile Life filed, and I have Mobile Life filed an appeal using my name, using my information, using false statements, sending false information, and said it was sent by me. Now, here's my other problem dealing with Medicare, which is an issue that I would like to take another time, but I know that's more federal. But anyway, I wrote every Medicare place in the country to get a copy of that. And I still, today, don't have a copy. 2.5 years, and this is one right here, 2.5 years after I've been writing to everyone, I've been through appeal after appeal, I did get this page right here that states that I did, that states it, that I sent in that appeal. First of all, if you send in an appeal in the Medicare system, the second appeal has to be on level two. Mm-hmm. And they sent another one in on level one. And what happened was I called the Human Services, Steve Lister, who was very helpful. He said, "I the only thing to do is go to appeal two and file and state every single thing that happened." And try to, the Medicare system is a multifunctional system, as I'm working with that, that's a whole other issue. And I've taken Mobilize to the district attorney again, because lawyers, it's going to cost me $10,000 for a lawyer. But and I'll tell you right now, I have a pay with my pay, and I won't. But there's other senior citizens that are. And Mobilize, you know, right after they started this appeal, they sent on, and they put it wrong. They put the wrong date. That I filed an appeal because they put my bill in the collection agency. I'm not that stupid. That they put out MSN, which is what you get when you're in Medicare. I don't know if you get Medicare. You get, they pay the bill, or they didn't pay the bill, or whatever. They attached to the appeal an MSN that's not in my file. I've been everywhere. And I don't know where they got it. They also had attached a letter, which took me 2.5 years to find out, showing this letter they wrote to me about collecting, and that's on there. And if that isn't superstitious, do you print a dated letter on the thing? So they did it. Once they found out they sent the wrong information in, they sent this in showing that they, you know, let me know that I owed them money. So they've done everything illegal. The Medicare system is beyond control. But I want you to know that we have so many people in our area, senior citizens living in rural areas, that will not call 911, including me. I would never call 911 and deal with it again. However, I did just recently get some very, very exciting news. I had, there's a newspaper article in here, I think, that the town of Walpole has, we want to resolve the problem. I hope I hope that I may get anything in here. But I read the town of Walpole has contracted, not with Mobile Life, they wouldn't contract with them. But, is that it right there? You've got
yes,
it? Yes. Yeah. I don't even know what page of that is. But anyway, town of Walpole has contracted with a service, I think, from New Jersey. And they provide a paramedic to get on the volunteer ambulance. And now the senior citizen gets the Medicare for the ambulance they deserve. That's great. My biggest, I want to get some, I know a lot of my students work at Flint Bush Ambulance Corps. I know a lot of people, my granddaughters belong to that. And I called Flint Bush Ambulance Corps the other day, a short time ago, to get something. And I had written Charlie Kahn, the town supervisor, regarding this whole problem, because he had commented in my newspaper article. And I had written the Pine Bush Ambulance Corps, pleading them to please get a contract, because it's killing our senior citizens. And this is my pride and joy that they have done it. And I think Mobile Life only signed because I live in this district, that they want to get their back. But I'll tell you something else that happened the other day, which is really, really... I'm very good friends with a legislator from Orange County, and this woman had written her that she called 911, and two ambulances showed up. So this is what they're doing now. You call 911, and somehow both ambulances get there at the same time. The paramedic from Mobile Life gets off the ambulance, checks the patient, and decides, they don't need a paramedic. So put them in the volunteer ambulance. The lady gets the bill for $700. Because once they put them in that other ambulance with the paramedic in or something. I'd like to tell everybody in the world, if they pull that on you, well, how do you tell a senior citizen, only get in the paramedic ambulance, because then you don't pay the bill. Now they're getting there at the same time, or else they're determining that you don't need the person, and, or you don't need the paramedic. So now if you need something stuck in the bill.
So what do you want these people to do for you, kids?
What do you want these people to do for you?
What do you want them to do for you?
That's the next question.
Yeah.
Okay. I would like you all to be aware of the situation, and that would help. Senator Gillibrand has helped me from day one. She's still helping me. She
specifically, like
I think number one, that awareness is a big part. And I think number two, I did file a case with the New York State Attorney, and I have filed a case also with the Federal Attorney General, because they said it's a federal problem. But I think it's very, very prevalent, and that I know in that article there, thinks there's 25 or 30 senior citizens, and they're making money on this. Otherwise, why would they attack me for one case to stop this? They're making double the money, the ambulances. So I talked to one lawyer, and they said, you know, our legislators should do something in the state level. I looked up the ambulance, the laws for ambulances, and they're almost non-existent. They are no. You need to do go to your state legislator, tell me who to go to. If I get time, I'm going to write the letters to all of them.
Mr. Knopp, is there anything in the office of the aging, is there any way for them to get involved in this situation, to be advocates for the senior citizens?
Well, actually, I think the county legislature did put in place an emergency management council.
And this committee is going to be one of the oversight committees. This committee and the law enforcement and public safety.
And it's also actually, ambulance services are regulated by, part of one of the things that they do is Department of State. So Department of State has some authority over how emergency services interact, so that was another avenue. So I think that's, you know, I didn't even think of that. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So what's that today's phone?
It's very similar to that. I don't know if you're familiar with the fire advisory board. And they meet also once a month. But
I also think it could be worthwhile going to the Office of the Aging Committee and let them know what's going on. They're aware of the situation too,
because
there are advocates, right?
Isn't
the
officer being? Well, we're, you know, the officers are aware of this. Again, it's Agent Gage is right. This, I mean, the case I just mentioned, you know, the correct your station. And it's very frustrating. You know, it works so hard, but, you know, personal emergency response services and so they can take contact with emergency services, keep them in the home, and then they'd be quite frustrated with having to face the light.
If Steve left his letter in here, he's the only person in Medicare in the entire country that helped me. Now, he's not there anymore. I can't talk to him anymore. But he did recommend that the state needs to mandate that these people have a contract so our seniors don't get stuck. And
can I ask a question? Because, you know, without a contract, you get the bill. What does the contract say? I mean, a local volunteer ambulance?
The contract, I think it's explained, it means that they're working together, so only they have to have a contract, otherwise they can't bill. If they don't have a contract, then they bill separately.
They share the bill?
Well, no, they'll get the regular... So it's mobilized, if they've got a contract, they'll get $350
from
Medicare. Yes, they will pay them. But without a contract, they'll get $675 from Medicare. So there's no... I also have a big issue with Medicare, which I'm going to take on, which I'm going to do a little report. You want a copy of that, Craig, when I get that?
That'll be fine.
Yeah, because everybody backs off from Medicare.
But if
I've had people from the Office of Aging. I've had someone helping me, but when I hit Medicare, he quit on me. Because I've been through all the five appeals of Medicare.
You've spoken with John Scott as well.
Who?
John Scott, he's the president of the Boca Raleigh Senior System. He's
with the
county. Wasn't he senior? Yeah, I think he was senior. Yeah. So.
I'm friendly with the local man too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, there's two good people to reach out to, but definitely John needs to get information. He's a good guy.
Okay. Well, I know who he is. He goes to
North
Dallas.
He does. Yeah. So do you think you have a clear cut paper trail where you can prove the falsification of your medical records in that appeal, in that false appeal that was filed?
Do I have it? One lawyer said he would help me if I could bring a copy of the...
Right, well, you should just go to Holly Cronwright's office, the Ulster County District Attorney's office. He's actually very active. I've had
personal conversations with him myself about falsification of business records. It's New York State Penal Code Section 175. Actually not really any clear distinctive language that directs law enforcement to conduct investigations in the area of medical and healthcare records when they're falsified. However, I've had several private conversations with Holly Cartwright in
Holly Cartwright?
Yeah, that he's the district attorney for Ulster County. His office has had some recent cases where they've prosecuted falsification of business records and medical records in the healthcare industry. They are quite well publicized in the recent months. So I know from my father had some experiences where there was some falsification of his medical records in another county. And I went through Medicaid hearing appeals, and I went through the third appeal, and then I finally won the appeal through a district court panel. But I did a lot of research on, you know, what the statutes are in New York State, and I had discussions with the county district attorney's office where the facility was in regards to my father, and they informed me that that's not something that they investigate. And then when I had some conversations with our district attorney, who happens to be a constituent of mine, he said that's something that my office, we hand out indictments on that all the time. He's like, if you ever want to have a private conversation with me, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
So I would highly recommend that you get in touch with them because, you know, depending on what they would determine that violation to be, that's either a misdemeanor or a felony.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's definitely something that they can investigate. If you have, you know, a clear-cut paper trail and you can explain, you know, your story and the chain of events to prove that there was falsification of business records that's in violation of Penal Code Section 175, then by all means, you know, that's the way to illuminate what's been going on here, because obviously it seems like there's collusion amongst, you know, the executives within the ambulance service to,
I don't want to speculate on legal matters. I don't think that that's...
Well, the thing I'm going to tell you, it's Medicare that's not giving me the information. I mean, 2.5 years just to get this false letter or whatever. And, you know, when I go to the district attorney in New York, he said it's a federal matter. Right? It's a big issue. And Medicare is really, the way they've treated me, the appeals, everything has been disgusting. And that's, I think, a whole other issue. That. But as far as, I just want to make the statement about Mobile Life. The people who own it are very greedy. The people that work in it are awesome. They're wonderful.
Right.
I'm not even condemning them. So
okay.
It is.
Very good, Bob. We appreciate your time. And at least we have you know, a better understanding and maybe some avenues that we can take as far as law the agency. And maybe you can reach out to Holly concerning your own personal legal matters.
My personal legal matters are concerned.
Okay.
And, I mean, I'm concerned with it. It's just upsetting when things are wrong like this. And I think, you know, if you can just bring this to the attention of a lot of people or tell them they can go to their ambulance and ask them to try to really start mending these contracts between them, that would solve it. Except now they're pulling the dummy.
If maybe you could reach out to... Ms. Page, when that panel was formed,
the EMS Council.
You have an opportunity to speak with them in the presence, not at all.
That's great, because I'm just proud. It's been 5 years.
Well, that's good.
Can I have a quick phone number here? Contact had a
I don't know if that's said, but just tell me how to get home. I mean, I get so lost. I have no sense of direction.
Well, you know how to get out of
here? I just got to get out to the, you know,
Nine?
Oh, is that what you're doing? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I take 30 feet. You go right in the Walker Valley, right?
Yeah, I know how to get from 209. I know how to get out of the city. And the sheriff could explain how I'll get here. He said, follow me. I'm not even going to tell you.
Make a left out of the parking lot onto Fair Street. No, John Street. Is that Fair?
what is this? Main Street.
Main Street.
Main Street.
Make it up there.
Yeah. Yep. Go through the light.
Washington Avenue, make a right.
Yeah, Washington Avenue, make a right, and go straight.
Okay, that'll take me right to the church.
That's easy.
Okay, left, Main, and right on Washington.
Left out of the park, you're in this parking lot behind the building?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Left, straight all the way till you hit Washington Avenue, and then make a right on Washington, go straight to the circle.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. And I'm willing to talk to anyone and everyone about
it. Time to horn. You circle the building a couple of times, time to horn.
Or I might be back.
What's your glasses? You want your glasses in there?
It's
$15.99.
All right, we'll move on. Tommy's got 30 seconds. Chuck, around, there's a good line. If you think it's a good idea, you'll have to come up with some kind of way to the Oakley County Mental Health Association is willing to take it on depending on what you really require of it. You know, basically, it's an autistic line. They're going to contact the schools to tell whatever experts said to report that the kids might be using drugs. Anything that causes suicide or getting bullied. I've been working in the Midwest, and this is an idea to, you know, make it work in our county.
Now, this is still their safe to talk?
This is the county mental health association.
Okay.
You can form your own.
Oh, completely.
Yes, that was favorite key because we might be able to include other counties in the area.
Right here.
This ramp is basically a subjective request that they've given our seniors in the last 6 years, asking them what kind of illicit drugs they're using. You know, within their lifetime, or within the last 30 days, and other questions. But that's the one I'm interested in. You can see 30% of our seniors are saying they've used within the last 30 days an illicit drug. And it's a security. It's based on their, whether they're answering truthful or not. Who the hell knows?
Right.
But 30% say they're using it. So, and with all the incidents we have that are the heroin epidemic and stuff like that, one would think that they're telling the truth. So this is a way of, as far as fund addiction, this is a way of getting liquid. The problem presented to their parents or some authorities, it's not challenging the way you're coming off. Or else you're going to wind up, you know, bought addicts or full addicts in, you know, 85, 10 years.
Now, it's along the same lines as the state's party, the anonymous tips.
Right, the anonymous tip line, the third party. But even the teachers, like, they may suspect, but, you know, it takes a little push power, or whatever you want to call it, to call the kid on it, and then, you know, they say, no, I didn't do it. Then the mother comes in saying, how dare you call that kid a junkie, and whatever. This came out of the public,
advisory committee. My concern is I think what could happen, I mean, I'm all for this, but we need the school districts on board. I think we need to go to the superintendent's council's meeting, you know, see if they can get on the agenda, and give them the company's going to be calling the schools, you know, they have to know what exactly is going to be. They're going to get 10 calls every day. Johnny Jones is doing drugs, or this kid bullied me, or, you know, somebody's bringing a gun in. They all have to be investigated. But are the schools the right contact for the service?
That would have to be developed. Yeah.
Because I think that something that came out of the Public Safety Advisory Committee was that the school districts did not participate in the study. In our committee, and that they were taken aback when we filed our report amongst, you know, newspaper articles and sending them to all the superintendents of the schools, that they didn't get a chance to participate. I think they had
been aggressive,
but I think that, you know, the schools should need to find out.
The idea is warrants to take it to the next step. after the before this committee started in 2014, I had gone to the executive because I thought that the public advisory board was not going to do anything with it other than the report. He said he would bring it to the schools when he meets with their principal. But I mean, it's something you should be working together for if you want to implement this idea. If you don't want to implement it, then I'm going to go out to the various charities to see if they'll do it. But then it'll be out of your control.
I don't want to control it. I want it to run. Here's what I envision, and I'm not stepping on your toes at all. So you have this company that's going to take the calls.
Right.
There's got to be some kind of protocol. Is it a high emergency type of thing, a medium or a low priority? And then if it's a high priority, a call to the local police. Medium priority.
Yeah, but
tool.
You can have a caveat, just like they do with the suicide tip line. That pretty good. If you feel that any bodily harm can occur, please call 911 immediately. Do not use this particular thing. But these are the things that has to be hammered out. But I don't know by Google.
Right. Well, I'd like to see what the schools think about it, because if we're targeting students.
Yeah, I'd like to see this implemented. I think Carl makes a good point. If they're the ones that are, bear the brunt of the calls and everything, they should be completely aware you want it. Transparent.
How are you going to
do that? Well, my professional position, I cannot advocate on a legislative term the school districts, but any of the other committee members can, or you can. You can send a letter to the...
I'm a little bit. I call up and it's legal.
Well, are you representing the League of Women Voters or yourself? It says here the League of Women Voters.
That's me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It's just relationship with the...
Oh, okay. With the advisors. All right.
Advisors.
Well, maybe we could get the chairman of the advisory committee and you to send a letter to the superintendent, Charles Ford, Dr. Charles Ford.
That was Mary Worrell.
Mary Worrell, yes. Asking to... have a sit down with them or attend the superintendent's council meeting and kick it up with them because they've got ideas too about public safety and about their schools and their security and their safety.
I think they're doing that as well.
They should be involved in the creation of this instead of just us taking something and saying, okay, now these people are going to get the calls.
I'm just saying, if you think it's an interesting...
I think it's a good thing.
Right, then you have to, pick it up a level. Somebody has to start taking over.
I mean, the county executive did take the step with the Suicide Prevention Act.
Right.
Okay, and I think the schools were responsive to that. Now, is that for Android too now? Do we have an Android version?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's an hour. Because I wanted to download it.
Just over Dutchess County, we partnered with them to offset the cost.
I mean, do you think that it could be expanded to, because in the Public Safety Study Advisory Committee, we had looked at an app for public safety for students, and it was a two-way app with a GPS type of thing, the location services, where if there was, God forbid, an active shooter or some emergency where kids were trapped in a school, that it could register their location as long as their phone was on. Because a lot of the Sheriff's Department had mentioned to us back in, 2005 or 6 when they had the shooting up in the mall. It took them all day to find people hiding in the mall, to get them out.
So there is a third-party report.
No, I understand that. Okay. I understand that. But, I mean, I don't know if that could be part of an app that you could report things from your phone app instead of calling the national hotline, and maybe it would be cheaper. I don't know. If the app is already developed, maybe we could add to it.
I will get together with Chairman Lopez and ex-chair Warrow.
Yes.
And we'll see what we can do to bring it to the next level. With that. Is that...
I think that's
my goal is to bring it to the school district. I don't understand how we can get this off the ground if it's a good idea.
Right.
You don't want to do it, then the
Okay. Okay. If you want to use up this motion. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move on to resolutions. All right. First of all, actually, I have 279. I think that's been taken off the agenda.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
This is professional service that we don't have to do on it. Last time it was our RFP, we intended to do 2-year contracts. We should have 1 year at county's option to renew. We always hesitate to look at the services, caring, extensive service. There are not a lot of vendors here in Hudson Valley that provide this level of service. And as a cost savings measure, we took advantage of that last option.
I'm confused though because it did pass this committee.
I know.
And I thought it passed Ways and Means.
I didn't know there was a problem, to be honest with you.
I
should learn the next day actually when I left the session, so just before being debated, I thought it was not consent, I didn't even have an objection to it.
So the sponsor is the county executive's office? So you would you withdraw it?
No, I withdraw it, yeah.
Yes. Because you wanted to go out to RFP?
No, you did.
Oh, you did?
Yes, it's a 2-year contract, and you moved the option. We were just taking advantage of the last option of the RFP, and the legislature decided that they did not want to do a big media on the RFP.
Okay. All right. I wasn't part of that debate.
Last year.
The contract was done last month.
Right.
What is the reason why that we did it backwards?
I don't know what happened with the time, to be honest. Usually we'll do them all at
once.
Okay. This is a pass to the federal
right?
Yep. 48 units, 33 tomorrow, 15 pounds. Okay, any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Good.
I'd like to move 331 for discussion.
Second.
We did one of these for Helen Bill a couple months ago, too, right?
Right.
How many districts do we do?
I don't have an answer for you.
Okay, yeah, it's not on a needs basis, it's whoever wants to participate.
Yeah, and that's what for 52,000 is. It's already implemented, right? Yeah, it's about going so. Yeah, and that's, And that's completely state funded?
Yeah.
Okay. Not from the county. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Good. 332. That's I'm adding the county budget to accept additional $216,976 for the mobile crisis services.
333 is establishing a petty cash fund for tobacco sales. Compliance enforcement is about $150.
What could come over $150
bucks? If I could explain, we've done this work for some
15 packs of cigarettes.
And what basically happens, we have a minor, someone who's under 18, and they work with the state attorney. And they go out and do compliance checks. We have to go check under our federal grant. We have to go check every retail establishment. Every year, we do it twice a year. They check every establishment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for years, can puff cigarettes, put them in the lot. And what would happen is the state attorneys would take it out of their own pocket. Mm-hmm. We can get into $20. And more often than not, they wouldn't be successful. We actually had a young man who's in Plymouth County right now who's just phenomenal at this. And over the summer, he purchased 8 packs of cigarettes from vendors in the county. And we realized that the cost of cigarettes is a lot of money for an employee mm-hmm. right out of pocket and right. get reimbursed. So we're looking to put a modest pay cash in place so as they can be successful in their compliance efforts, they can then have a way to reimburse.
So that's twice a year?
I did.
You get the money back if you're successful.
Well, yeah, but we have the cigarette, we have cheap cigarettes, and we have it as evidence.
Oh, okay. Mm. So technically, you could go up, you go to $150 on 15 grinds.
Yeah. Okay. We can't sell them any cash without permission.
Right.
Excuse me, when you came, you said before, you have to check every establishment?
They do, yeah.
So you mean every single establishment?
That sells cigarettes, yeah.
In the county? How many is that?
Several hundred.
I'm throwing a number, but I'll clarify it for the next thing. It's about 300, actually.
That's not even more. Gee, that's quite an arduous task.
It's an important thing to do, and again, we actually have a young man. I give him a lot of credit. He's been very successful, and he's been calling in, and he's been coming out with your... He buys, cigarettes and also chewing tobacco. He buys new tobacco.
You keep each establishment once a year or twice a year?
I believe they try to do twice in a cycle.
Wow. Well, that's impressive.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
All in favor for the 105.
There's some legislation coming in the next session we're proposing has to do with tobacco retailers posted schools. And mm-hmm. as part of that, I'll have all the documentation about where the retailers are located and how many there are. So we'll go back to the next couple months.
All right. Okay. Thanks.
Like advertising?
You're
advertising?
All right, we'll move on.
You're advertising? Your school channel, you know, just put signs out in front of them.
This is for good sales.
This is all sales.
All right, Resolution 338. This is for the county. The family woodstock. This agreement is to provide support services through supervision and treatment services for those that have received PIMS and JD. This is a new contract.
Sure.
Yeah,
All right, that's it with resolution. Any new business? Contracts?
I know it's an abstract for the contracts. You don't need to hold on those?
No, they're just here
for the contract. Oh, all right. That's a brother.
Well, the other is
okay.
The rest of them are not really.
They're not from our committee, then.
New business? Old business? Herb?
Can I make a motion for adjournment?
All right.
Did I get all of these?